time for Capital Thinking, where we analyze the key policy, political, legal, and business issues that will shape America's future. Live from Washington, D.C., this is your unfiltered tour of the halls of power. Now, here's your host, Kevin O'Neill.
All right, good afternoon, everybody, and getting an early start on your Memorial Day weekend. Happy Memorial Day weekend to you. We've got a number of key issues to talk about today. We're later in the show. We're going to talk a little bit about George W. Bush and the warrantless NSA surveillance of the New York Times and what's happened in a whistleblower case there. And then we're also going to talk about the new emerging intersection between IRS scrutiny of political contributions and whether or not those constitute gifts. But we're going to start by continuing our discussions about what's happening in a slowly recovering economy by talking about how to successfully sell your private business. Joining us today are Stephen Owen and Andrew Onenschloss with the Bernstein Global Wealth Management Group. So, guys, welcome to you. How are you all today?
We're great.
Well, let me just give everyone a quick sense of who you are. Stephen's vice president, who's been with the firm about 15 years and has a great deal of experience in the financial services world. And Andrew is a director of the Wealth Management Group. He's got a law degree from the University of Virginia and has been rated as one of the best lawyers in America. So, guys, take a moment to tell us a little bit about Bernstein Global Wealth Management and what it is you do for your clients every day.
Thanks, Kevin. This is Steve. Let me get started. I'm a principal in the Dallas office, and Bernstein has been in the global investment management business since 1967, and for all those 44 years, we've really done one thing, and that's just investment research and management. We're very focused, very targeted, and have a true mission on what we're trying to accomplish. We're fiduciary to our clients, and we really differentiate ourselves by setting up our processes to provide solutions to our clients, the financial issues that they face, so that they can more successfully meet their financial goals. One of the key resources that we use to provide these solutions is our wealth management group. And let me introduce my colleague, Andrew, who's a key member of that group. Andrew?
Thank you, Steve. Thank you, Kevin. Yeah, so at the Wealth Management Group at Bernstein, we have a group of mathematicians, CPAs, and former practicing lawyers like myself. And our goal is to help Bernstein understand, you know, what the planning and financial lives of our clients are so that we can both tool our investment advice to them appropriate for what they want to do. But we're also, because we're so interested in solutions, we're able to help in a lot of areas, and our research has led to a set of analytical tools which are extremely helpful to anybody who might be interested in selling their business. We're not going to know, you know, how to value their business or how to structure the sale itself, but we're going to be able to help shed a lot of light on what life post-sale might look like, and that kind of forecasting ability is going to help business owners make good decisions while they make the sale.
Well, Steve and Andrew, I know that we've obviously had a few years of very difficult business conditions, and I imagine a lot of people selling their businesses in that environment were conducting a fire sale, you know, trying to get something before things went even further south. Now, I'm wondering sort of what's the level of merger and acquisition transactional work at this point in time, and what's sort of bringing business owners back to the marketplace if they are coming back?
Well, let me start with that. This is Steve. Owners are having very mixed feelings, you know, about the decision of whether to sell their company or not. On the one hand, you know, the pre-2008 was a magnificent time to be selling your company because of massive liquidity in the market, easy lending practices by the financial institutions, great earnings, great consumer confidences resulted in valuations and quantity of M&A deals at record levels. On the other hand, the credit crisis of 2008 brought a striking reversal and brought everything really to a halt, and it didn't really matter how much money you had or how little money you had. After 2008, everyone was affected by that, so business owners are thinking, well, even at these depressed levels, should I go ahead and sell now that the economy is recovering some because we might experience another event like 2008? So it's a very mixed situation. We're starting to see some more M&A activities that will pick up significantly probably in the next 18 months because of the health of corporate balance sheets and the cash that's been accumulated on those corporate balance sheets. But the owners themselves are you know, in the dilemma of what do I do?
Sure. Well, let me follow up. What are you saying to owners as they sort of take a footstep back into the marketplace? Is this a situation where, because the recovery is so slow, Steve, you have to think about selling now, or can you really still hold out in hopes that there are much higher valuations to come if the economy improves in a couple of years?
Well, Kevin, that's a really key issue, and it depends, as always, on a lot of variables. But what our role is to be one of the team, to be part of the team of the seller's investment banker, corporate attorney, T&E attorney, accountant. But our role is really to help the owner understand the implications if he or she does sell the company, or if they wait, what are the implications of that? And one of the most important things that they need to really look at is, after all taxes, will the price that they're being offered be sufficient to accomplish the owner's financial goals? We call that concept core capital. Another way to look at core capital is, do they have the money they need to ensure their spending needs for the rest of their life with a high degree of confidence, regardless of what markets do in the future? Andrew's done a lot of work on that, and I might let him just talk a little bit about core capital and the work they've done there.
Yeah, so there's obviously a lot of risk for the business owner who's thinking about taking a lower price than they want. And you know, of course, there's the possibility that when they take the proceeds and invest them, that markets might be poor. Of course, they might live a very long time. Inflation might be a factor. And so our analytical tools are designed to help address all those risks and stress test the sales price to see what is the degree of likelihood that the sales price is going to support the owner and the owner's spouse and the lifestyle that they want to for a long time to come. Of course, how the sale is structured could be very important here. So, for example, if the sales price includes a lot of stock of the acquiring company, that's a very important feature for the business seller to take into account, because, of course, a single stock position has got inherently greater risks and, of course, inherently greater potential rewards. But we focus on the risks. In terms of the lifestyle of the owner after the transaction, earnouts are another thing you've got to be careful about. You've got to look at what happens if the earnout targets are not met and the full sales price does not materialize. And taxes, of course, right? One of the problems, if the owner decides that they're not going to sell today, that they're going to sell in the future, is, well, have they deferred the sale into a higher capital gains rate environment? And that could greatly affect, the total proceeds that they see at the end of the day.
Very good. Well, let me back up just a minute and ask you, Steve and Andrew, are there market segments that you all work with that are percolating the activities a little higher than others, or are you seeing across the board renewed interest in these transactions?
This is Steve. We're obviously in the social media. We're seeing a lot of activity going on there. Technology has been another sector of the market where you're starting to see some M&A activity. But if you look across all corporations in general, the thing that's been leading us out of the recession and what's been leading the recovery is not housing and the consumer, which is normally what happens in a recession. It's really been corporate profitability. Corporations have done the right things. They've right-sized. They've downsized. They've accumulated cash, they paid off debt, and they're generating free cash flow at levels that are at record levels, and that free cash flow with these low interest rates needs to be put to work. So we're really seeing interest across a lot of different sectors, but obviously the two that I mentioned are the most prominent.
Very interesting. And Andrew, let me come back to you. You talk a little bit about core capital, and I'm trying to get a better understanding of, if I'm a business owner, how do I understand this core capital concept and use it to determine if I'm taking a deal at the right price or if I should be accepting a lower price than what I had in mind?
Okay, so core capital, the basic information that we need to help think about core capital is sort of what is the expected spending going forward? And for lots of business owners, this is a bit of a cold shower because they think their spending is X, but when you tease out all the spending that's coming through the business, it turns out to be X plus something pretty significant. So we take that spending, we take a look at what the proceeds will be after tax. We can take a look at different stock bond investment mixes for those proceeds, and then we use our model to cast 10,000 plausible outcomes for the investments, net of taxes, net of the selected spending, and adjusted for inflation out for the relevant, you know, life expectancy of the couple, and see if indeed they are likely to have their wealth outlive them, which of course is what everyone wants.
Yeah, we all certainly want that. Well, what if the offered sales price is below the core capital, Andrew?
Yeah, so that becomes a really important piece of information to understand. And I guess some owners are going to take a look at that and say, look at their business and reevaluate whether the business has a decent chance of recovering enough so that they should wait for a sale and you know, hope to build their core capital number that way. Another possibility is to accept the lower price today, and then invest the proceeds with a little more risk reward, a little more kind of bigger stock component, and you know, hope that the capital markets behave going forward and build core capital through a diversified portfolio. But the information of core capital becomes, as you see, an absolutely crucial thing for the business owner to understand up front.
Very good. Well, we're talking with two gentlemen from Bernstein Global Wealth Management. We're going to be back in just a minute with more Capital Thinking.
Stocks, bonds, investment opportunities, financial news, and talk. We can help. Call us now toll-free, 866-472-5790. 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
If you find yourself under the Klieg lights of a government investigation, you want experience on your side. Patton Boggs has 46 years of it. We've handled some of the biggest white-collar crime cases. Put that experience to work for you.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
It's all about action.
Touchdown!
Scores.
Taking a look at the NBA tonight.
Highlights.
He's broken loose. He's at the 30.
And headlines.
Big trade in the NFL this afternoon.
When you are looking to talk sports, look no further than the Voice America Sports Network. We bring you some of the biggest names and all the sports news you can handle, whether it's basketball.
Off the glass.
Football.
Come on. Finish.
Golf. Racing. Or the Olympics. We've got you covered. We'll even cover tailgating. Tune in to the Voice America Sports Network. It's all things sports.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hear ye, hear ye. The House will come to order.
Having trouble sorting out what's going on Capitol Hill? Patton Boggs can cut through it all. We've got the insight, the know-how, the connections to navigate. Patton Boggs. Straight, unfiltered. Patton Boggs, a bipartisan voice with knowledge and 46 years of experience.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's K-O-Neill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, welcome back, everybody. We are talking with Stephen Owen and Andrew Auchincloss of Bernstein Global Wealth Management, talking about the strategies for successfully selling a private business in this very tough marketplace. And so, guys, welcome back. We were talking a little bit about core capital before we went to commercial break. And so, Steve, let me pick it back up with you and ask, if you're lucky enough in this marketplace to actually get offered a sales price that's above your core capital and you produce some excess capital, what are you doing to help business owners sort of plan for that success and make use of that excess capital?
Well, it's important, Kevin, to remember that when you negotiate a price, you know, up to the core capital line, what the owner's really doing is he's negotiating for the future lifestyle of himself and his spouse. Above that is what we call excess. And when we're doing that, it's really a legacy for the children or the third generation of the family or possibly charity. So in doing that, and trying to come up with an asset allocation and investment plan, it gives us a lot more time and we can afford to take a little bit more risk, which would tilt us more to equities. In the core capital, we're trying to ensure with a 90 to 95% probability that we meet those spending needs. And so that would tend to have us tilt more toward a bond-centric investment process. But bonds underperform stocks on an average of about 4% a year, so we would tilt more to equities when we have a longer time horizon for the children, for the next generation of children, and for a charity.
Very good. Well, I know when you start talking about selling a lot of businesses this day and age, of course, most classic small businesses are often owned by a husband or a wife or a family team, and so you get into some issues of estate planning. Andrew, walk us through what some of the key decision sort of roadmarks are for somebody who's making one of these sales, has some excess capital, and needs to effectively estate plan.
Yeah, so you know, the good news of excess capital is there's obviously been a lot of success for the family. The bad news is that absent some prudent actions, some of that excess is probably going to be taken by the government in the form of estate taxes at death. So it's an unusual period of estate tax laws right now. As many listeners may know, the president signed into law a new tax bill last December that puts a surprisingly generous estate tax regime into place with a 35% top rate and a $5 million exclusion for everybody, so couples can potentially exclude $10 million from the estate tax. It's also surprisingly temporary, though, because this estate tax law is scheduled to sunset at the end of 2012, at which point the law as it's written today will revert back to a much more punitive estate tax with only $1 million exclusion and a 55% rate. Congress might change that, but of course nobody knows. And so I think it's fair for the business owners to plan on a long-term basis for there to be some kind of meaningful estate tax, and so that the tax savings available through proper planning are something to keep an eye on.
Interesting. And I'm sorry, Steve, did you have anything to add to that?
Yeah. Andrew, go into the pre-transaction planning versus the post-transaction planning and how owners should think about the pre and what's a proper time to initiate that.
Yeah, so unfortunately, most business owners, in our experience, don't come to the planning part of all of this and thinking about estate planning until the sale is already, if not already, completed. The problem there is that once you know what the sales price is with any kind of certainty, any transfers you make to kids or grandkids, either of the proceeds or of the business before the sale, are going to be fully valued. So the opportunity here is if the business owner can get out enough in front of this and start thinking about sharing some of the business interests with kids or grandkids long before the transaction, then the opportunity exists to have appraisers come in and say that the business, particularly in today's environment, is, you know, not got a full valuation, and so that you can now make transfers to children and grandchildren at a lower valuation, and then when the sale ultimately occurs, they will share in the upside.
Very interesting.
And owners, in doing the pre-transaction, they always are reluctant to transfer control or ownership of the company even to their own children. But, Andrew, talk about some techniques that can allow some of that to happen but still have the owner, you know, maintain some of that control.
Yeah, so the control issue is always a big one in these things. Another issue besides control is the problem that, you know, if you're way out in front of the any kind of sales transaction, the owner typically doesn't know what the sales price is going to be, and so the fear is, well, if I make gifts to my kids today at lower valuations, but then a good sales price doesn't come through, haven't I hurt myself? And so there are lots of ways, though, for the business owner way out before a transaction to make transfers only of future appreciation in the business. There's a bunch of ways to do this, but a very effective one is a so-called GRAT or grantor retained annuity trust, where at no gift tax cost, the grantor can give future upside in his interest in the business to his kids at a potentially low valuation. And then when the sale ultimately comes in, if it's below expectations, the owner gets all of the sales proceeds, but if it's above expectations, that excess will be given to the kids and no gift tax will have been paid.
Very
so that can be effective.
And the grats, we do rolling grats, and they can be from 2 or 3 or 4 year maturities. There's a lot of, you know, involved execution of really doing the day-to-day of making those grats work, and we're very experienced in all the Bernstein offices in dealing with grats and paying the annuity payments and getting the attorneys to draft the documents in time to meet the deadlines that are in each of the individual grats. And so we do all that at no charge to our clients, and it really makes a very sophisticated planning tool work for the client.
Well, Steve, let me stick with that. How is Bernstein helping implement a comprehensive strategy for their clients?
Well, we view ourselves as really part of the overall team. In doing complicated emotional transactions, it's really important that the owners of businesses have a very good team. And we view ourselves as one of the people that needs to be at the table with the team members that we mentioned earlier. And the reason for that is this pre-planning gives the owner an opportunity to do passing money to the second and third generation and to do charities. It's a very opportunistic time to do this, and with just a little bit of planning, you can really make a big difference. Also, when we solve for core capital, we let the owner know that his goals are going to be met with a high degree of confidence. We model that, we let them pre-experience that, and we take the abstract and move it to objective mathematics that are put on a page and show an owner that they're going to be able to meet their goals. And then we help them really with the structure of being able to look at different deal terms, to look at different planning and strategies, and then run that through the model that Andrew and his group do to come up with this is the trade-off between each of these various strategies. And so in doing that, what we really do is we give the clients the comfort and the confidence to either proceed with the transaction or not to proceed if it doesn't meet their goals and objectives. We've been doing this a long time. It's really the only thing we do. And again, it's just one example of how we go about solving the financial issues that our clients face in meeting their overall financial goals.
Andrew, anything to add to that?
No, that was I strongly endorse all that.
Well, Steve, we got about 2 minutes left. Tell us a little bit about your website and how people who are interested in Bernstein can find out a little more info about you guys.
Well, you can contact us. We do have a very robust website, and you can contact us at our website address, or you can call any of the Bernstein offices across the country. You can call me in the Dallas office, and if you're located in another part of the country, I can get you with a financial advisor that would be in that office. And again, Kevin, Andrew, and I just really appreciate the opportunity to come on the show today. We think what you guys are doing is great. And
sure, hit us with the website, Steve. What's the website address?
It's www.bernstein.com.
All right, bernstein.com. Well, we've been joined by Stephen Owen, the Vice President and the Principal at Bernstein Global Wealth Management, as well as Andrew Auchincloss, who is the Director of the Wealth Management Group. We're going to be back in just a minute to talk about a fascinating New York Times whistleblower scandal here with more Capital Thinking in just a moment.
It's up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now, toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
What's your name worth? The loss of a single patent, trademark, or copyright can cost millions. Make sure your intellectual property is protected. Trust Patton Boggs to manage and protect your most important assets.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Technology is changing the way we live our lives and how we do business. On CIO Talk Radio, we talk about the benefits of technology and the great things it allows us to do, as well as its risks. Heard every Wednesday at 9 a.m. Central, 7 a.m. Pacific, Sunjo Gall interviews business leaders and other experts that are shaping the way we use technology. To learn more about the show, visit www.ciotalkradio.com. Keep up with the changing world of technology and listen to CIO Talk Radio with Sunjo Gall. Listen in every Wednesday at 9 a.m. Central, 7 a.m. Pacific, right here on Voice America Business.
Are you looking for innovative ideas on how to achieve your financial dreams? Tune in to Empirical Investing Radio every Thursday afternoon at 2 Pacific, 5 Eastern on the Voice America Business Channel. Join certified financial planners Ken Smith and Ethan Broga to learn how you can obtain financial success. You'll be entertained while you discover techniques to alleviate your financial concerns. Empirical Investing Radio every Thursday at 2 Pacific, 5 Eastern on the Voice America Business Channel.
business community's first choice in Internet Talk Radio. Voice America Business Network.
From Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's K-O-Neill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right. Well, welcome back, everybody. We've got one of our favorite guests joining us for this segment. It's Jay Darden, former federal prosecutor. Jay's now with my law firm, Patton Boggs, here in Washington, D.C., but he used to be the assistant chief for the criminal division's fraud section at the Department of Justice. And we're going to talk a little bit about one of these cases that's in the news that involves some really key issues. Big names like the New York Times, President George W. Bush, and a hot topic involving wiretapping surveillance. So, Jay, take us through sort of the basics of this case and who the key players are.
Thank you, Kevin. It's good to be back with you. This really is a fascinating case. It's one that dates back to the early days of President George W. Bush's first term in the wake of the September 11th attacks. As you may recall, after 9/11, there was a program put in place by the Bush administration to increase its ability to monitor conversations and email traffic between U.S. citizens and foreign nationals abroad. This program later became known in our political vernacular as the Warrantless Wiretap Program, which was disclosed in an article by the New York Times in December of 2005. In 2008, the Justice Department lawyer who leaked this program's information to the New York Times, a DOJ lawyer named Thomas Tam, came out publicly in another news article in Newsweek and said, "I did this. I am the leaker," which of course is very unusual in a case like this. The investigation of Mr. Tam had been going on for years at that time and continued for years after he admitted being the leaker, until just a few weeks ago when it was publicly reported that the Department of Justice had decided to drop the case against Mr. Tam and told him in a letter that he would not be prosecuted.
Well, that seems very unusual, you know, that you could be that involved, be the leaker. But I guess that's sort of the way these things are, right? I mean, the leaker is always somebody that was in a position of trust to have access to the information that they're leaking. But why, in such a high visibility case, is the Department of Justice dropping the case, Jay?
Well, Kevin, it's impossible for us to know what the exact rationale was within DOJ. None of the news stories about this case have contained any additional information. The letter to Mr. Tam apparently didn't explain DOJ's decision, and as you might expect, DOJ has not commented publicly on why it chose to drop the case. The one thing that we do know is that DOJ is not going forward with this case because it's soft on leaks in national security cases. In fact, quite the opposite is true. The Obama administration in the last couple of years when it's been in office has brought five cases against national security-related leakers. And although in the grand scheme of things, five cases may not seem like a lot, there were only three such cases brought in the previous 40 years before the Obama administration came into office. So the Obama administration has actually had a very robust program through the Department of Justice in investigating and prosecuting leak cases. This particular case, however, was one where the administration decided not to go forward. As you know, the program at issue in this leak, again, the so-called warrantless wiretapping program, was very controversial politically and legally throughout the later years of the Bush administration. Both President Obama and Attorney General Holder, as part of the 2008 presidential campaign, were on record as being opposed to the program. And we can only speculate that that may have had something to do with the department's decision not to go forward with the case. Also, as a former prosecutor, I can tell you it's very difficult to imagine the closing argument in a case like this where you are trying to prosecute the individual leaker when at the same time high-level officials of the administration are on record as being against the program. So we can only speculate as to what the exact reason was, but I would imagine it has something to do with the overall political controversy that surrounded the program and the potential difficulties the politics of the program would have had at a trial.
I got you. And do you mentioned the administration's position. Is the administration, you know, leaks are always a sensitive subject inside an administration. You know, they like to go on witch hunts, figure out what's going on. Is the Obama administration taking a different tack than the Bush administration would in handling this?
Well, the one thing, as I mentioned earlier, that we know that the Obama administration isn't backing down. I mentioned before that there were five cases that have been brought in the last 2 years compared with only three cases in the last 40 years. Now, in fairness, at least two of those five cases actually involve investigations that had begun under the Bush administration. So I'm not sure that I would say that the Obama administration is taking a different tack with respect to the issue of national security leaks overall, but rather is continuing what started under the Bush administration and is continuing, like I say, a very robust program of investigating and prosecuting these cases.
Well, what I think so newsworthy about this case here is you've got a real clash between values and perhaps constitutional principles, talking about First Amendment rights, you know, the New York Times obviously being involved in things like sure. Pentagon Papers in the past, all the way to the WikiLeaks today, to national security. You have a lot of people who are very concerned that the more our enemies know about what we're doing in the area to catch them, the easier it is for them to adapt their tactics away from ways for us to detect their future moves.
So that's right.
Tell me a little bit about how the DOJ balances those interests and what it bodes for the future, what this case bodes for their future.
Well, you're exactly right. The balance of interest in these national security leak cases is very, very difficult. I will tell you that in cases involving leaks to the media, there are a number of internal DOJ guidelines and steps that have to be complied with prior to issuing any sort of subpoena for documents or testimony to, for instance, the reporter who is the one who received this leak information. It's very difficult to balance those kinds of interests, even though internal DOJ guidelines require that the Department of Justice do that. My own view, Kevin, is that we need some additional guidance from Congress on this issue. I am firmly of the view that we need to have in place a system that distinguishes types of leaks, and I'll just give you an example. To me, it's one thing when there is a national security leak to a reporter of something that is highly newsworthy and something that furthers our public dialogue under the First Amendment. That case to me is a very, very different case than an instance where someone leaks classified information, say, to the embassy of a country hostile to the United States.
Yeah, that sounds like espionage.
That's exactly right. And although the charges could be very similar, in the sense that you are disclosing classified information, my own view is that we need a different regime for these cases that differentiates between those types of leaks. I also think as part of that regime, we need greater protection for news outlets and for individual reporters that are reporting on this type of information. This is a subject that's fairly controversial. And in fact, after the New York Times publication of the article on this warrantless wiretapping issue, as well as prior administration policies of rendition and other things, there were calls in Congress for actual investigation and prosecution of the reporters who were disclosing this information. My own view is that that is not right. In our system of government, reporters are there to report. And if someone brings newsworthy information to them, they're going to report it. And that's one of the foundations of our constitutional democracy and freedom of the press, in my view, is very important to our system of government. So my own view is that in addition to distinguishing between the reason for the leak, we also need a system based in federal law that gives greater protection to reporters and news outlets than we currently have on the books.
Well, so Thomas Tamm, obviously a pretty distinguished guy to get a job at DOJ where he could be in this position of responsibility, and now that he's been cleared, talk to me a little bit about what this all means for his future professionally.
Well, you're exactly right. He is someone who had a distinguished career. I have to confess, I didn't know Mr. Tamm personally, but he comes from a family with a long background of serving the United States in the Department of Justice. His father and his uncle served under J. Edgar Hoover at the FBI. His mother worked for the FBI as well, and he was, for the majority of his career, a government prosecutor, both at the state level and at the Department of Justice. As you can imagine, though, all of the pressure associated with this issue has really sidelined his career. There have been news reports about the fact that he had to ultimately resign from his position as a United States attorney at the Department of Justice, that he was unable to fulfill his duties because he was racked with guilt and worrying about the situation he was in. And, of course, for the last several years, he's been living under the threat of prosecution, which is a pressure that would break almost any of us. I'm hopeful that now that he's out from under the pressure that was imposed on him by this investigation, that he'll be able to rejoin the legal profession and maybe even rejoin the Department of Justice. I don't know that that's likely, but I do wish Mr. Tamm the best and hope that he's able to rally and resume his normal life.
Well, it's a very, very interesting case, and be interesting to see what it means for future leakers. Jay Darden joining us to talk about the New York Times and the unwarranted wiretapping surveillance investigation involving DOJ lawyer Thomas Tamm. We're going to be back in just a minute to talk about the intersection between the IRS and political giving, here with more on Capital Thinking in just a moment.
Markets up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now, toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
From K Street to Wall Street to LaSalle Street, the Patton Boggs team knows how to pull off big business transactions. Come hear what we know. Patton Boggs covers the world.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Interrogatories.
Prima facie.
Pleadings.
Motion for summary judgment.
E-discovery.
Affirmative defense.
Stipulations.
Ex parte.
Amicus brief.
Subpoena.
Litigation is confusing. Trust the litigation team at Patton Boggs to make sense of it all.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
The same firm that's been navigating the government maze for more than four decades is also the same firm that can help you protect your most important assets. Whether it's a valuable patent, an important copyright, or your next big idea, Patton Boggs is committed to protecting your intellectual property.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network. Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill at pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, welcome back, everybody. We're talking with George Schutzer now, a partner at Patton Boggs in the area of tax law, about some recent developments between the intersection of political contributions and the IRS. So, George, we understand that the IRS is starting to take a look at the gift implications of some political contributions made to particular types of entities. I know it's been a long time since the IRS has really looked at the gift tax implications of political contributions. Why are they doing that now?
It's a good question as to why they're doing it now. In the early 80s and late 70s, they raised questions and brought some litigation relating to contributions to political campaigns, asserting that they were gifts. They won some litigation, lost some, but eventually Congress turned them around and excluded from the gift tax contributions to political organizations, but in doing so did not specifically exclude contributions to Section 501c4 social welfare organizations. The social welfare organizations, or C4s, have become more active recently in the political scene. And some speculate, and certainly six Republican senators who sent a letter to the Commissioner of Internal Revenue think that perhaps the concern or the review of the gift tax returns has been politically motivated or motivated by a concern at the White House about the strength of the 501c4 organizations. It's also possible on the flip side that while the IRS has had an informal policy of not pursuing these, it may be a policy that, because it wasn't a formal policy, that some out in the field were not aware of, and they may have begun the inquiries based on information that they had, and the IRS National Office, out of concern about having appearances of being involved politically, has chosen not to cause them to pull back on those inquiries. So it's hard to tell what has triggered the inquiries.
Interesting. Well, walk us through a little bit, what is actually the black letter law on these contributions to these 501c4 organizations?
The black letter law is hard to really determine. As a general rule, a gratuitous transfer by an individual to another party is subject to the gift tax. And they're relatively limited exclusions. In fact, even a contribution to a 501c3 organization, a charity, is technically a gift, and then there's a deduction from the gift tax for the fact that it's a charitable gift. So it's generally ignored that way. What's often difficult to tell is whether a contribution to an organization is made in consideration for something, in which case it would not be a gift, or whether it's a gratuitous transfer. And when the 501c4 organization, where the benefits flow indirectly to the contributor, or they help achieve a contributor's political or legislative or personal goals, the role of the situation is more ambiguous. So the service took the position in a 1982 ruling that contributions to organizations other than political organizations were, as a general rule, taxable gifts. But they did so in a way that was really contrary to the holdings of some of the cases that had come down on political contributions. So one would have to describe the law as uncertain, and there really not being a lot of good black-letter law in the area.
Well, George, I'm sure that's what a lot of our listeners are wondering. So they may not give to 501c4s, but they may give to, you know, Steve Smith for Congress, a general political contribution. Are those now potentially taxable events?
No, there's a statutory exemption for those. So those are not subject to the gift tax.
Well, that I'm sure folks will breathe a sigh of relief there, although that would be a great excuse to stop political giving if it turned out to be a taxable event. So lots of these 501c4 entities are out there. What sort of advice are you giving them as they try and work their way through this this fog where to figure out what the law is and how it's going to apply to them?
Number one, don't panic. First of all, contributions that are made for business purposes in furtherance of business goals are probably not subject to the gift tax in the first place. So there's one category that can come in without any problem. Second, corporations are not subject to the gift tax, so don't be concerned about gifts from corporations. As a technical matter, if a corporation makes a gift, the shareholders may be treated as making a gift. That's usually not a problem with respect to broadly held corporations, because no gift tax is imposed on gifts of less than $13,000. So if you spread it over the shareholders, none of them would be making taxable gifts. Could be a problem for some closely held corporations. We have encouraged 501c3 organizations, though, to be upfront with their larger donors. In the past, we've encouraged them to tell their larger donors that there is a possibility that the gift tax would apply. So if things like this popped up, they would be aware of it. And we were now encouraging 501c4 organizations to go the step further and at least inform their larger donors that we're aware of 5 cases in which the IRS has sent letters of inquiry or examination, but has not made a formal decision on it. We also then suggest that the 501c4 organization encourage the contributor, if the contributor has doubts, to talk to his tax counsel or tax advisor to ascertain what the real risks are.
Very good. George, why don't you hit us with your email address so that people who are interested in learning more about this situation know how to get in contact with you.
It's gschutzer@patentbogs.com. That's gschutzer@patentbogs.com.
Very good. Well, George has been joining us to make sure that people are up on the latest IRS interpretations of political contributions to a new and fast-growing segment of the market, these 501c4 organizations. We've had a great Capital Thinking this week. We launch into the Memorial Day weekend. We've had a chance to talk about selling your business successfully in a whistleblower case at DOJ, in addition to having George. We're going to be back next week with another fantastic episode of Capital Thinking. But until then, have a great Memorial Day weekend.
Thank you for joining us for Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. We hope to have you join us again for more insight from Washington. We're here every Thursday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, noon Eastern, on the Voice America Business Network.